Hello, good morning, everyone. This is John Patika Jr. over at the Patika Wealth Management Group, and I'm accompanied here with John Patika Sr., who is our head member of our team here in Clearwater, Florida. And we got a pretty packed schedule here for you today with a lot to cover with the electric grid. And we've got three of our top analysts over at UBS. Let's go here as our guests. We have Steve Fisher, who's one of our industrial analysts that covers machinery, engineering, and construction. We've got Greg Orrell, who is our executive director of the North America Utilities Equity Research, and then the head of our North America Power and Utilities Equity Research team, Ross Fowler. So, gentlemen, welcome to our podcast and call today.
Glad to be here.
Thanks, Ross. I think this is an investment theme going forward that we need to explore. And the more I talk about it with people, the more I realize that people don't quite understand what the grid is. Some think it's a tic-tac-toe board put over a map of the United States, and they don't realize that in some places it's quite fragmented and antiquated. Take whatever time you need, Ross, to explain to us, help us understand what is this grid, regional versus this national impression we have.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a term that everybody throws around, but I don't know that everybody that throws it around actually knows what it is when they say the grid, quote unquote. So you have to remember, I think, that electricity started 100 years ago in the United States, really rolling out, and it was developed around a lot of local and state regulation. And utilities are still regulated at the state level today for the majority of the regulation they face around economic returns and so forth. So you ended up growing up with a lot of regional grids. So the grid in the United States is actually a bunch of individual grids based on geography. So there's a New England grid, there's a New York grid, there's PJM, which is sort of the Mid-Atlantic grid, and actually stands for Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Maryland. It's a little bit wider than that into Illinois and down. There's CERC, which is the majority of the Southeast. There's Florida. Texas is its own grid. There's the MISO, which is kind of the Midwest Independent Systems Operator. So think about that as sort of the plain states in the Midwest a little bit. Then you hit the Rocky Mountains, and nobody's building a transmission line across that. So, you know, there's all the grids out in the West, including California, which is mainly its own grid. And the reason all of these sort of individual grids exist, like, is because when electricity started, we started building out the grid. There was actually a debate between Edison and Tesla about whether AC or DC was better. Edison won that debate probably because he was a better marketer, and we went with an AC grid, and that's where we stand. And the thing with alternating current is you can't send it very far without experiencing a lot of line losses across the transmission line. So you can't like build a solar farm in Arizona and dispatch it across a transmission line, even if the Rocky Mountains weren't there, into New York. It just doesn't work that way. You'd lose so much electricity in the process that it wouldn't be economic to do that. So you have a bunch of individual grids across the United States. And it can get a little parochial because you have individual state regulators in all 50 states that regulate the utilities in those states. And so trying to integrate across grids can get difficult or more complex. So you know, you have to keep all of that in mind. One last thing I'll say just to clarify. So I think we're going to talk a lot about transmission today. The grid is actually the generation side, which is all the power plants, which is feeding those electrons to the grid. And then you've got two different pieces of sort of the grid. It's transmission, which are the big high tower power lines you see out there on these giant towers. And then there's the distribution system, which would be the lines that you actually see outside of your house.
Okay, so let's talk next about the state of the grid, you know, who pays to upgrade them. And I think that some of these guys don't get along, right? There's a little rivalries. Maybe you can touch on that.
Yeah, so let's talk about that a little bit. So the grid was probably underinvested in for a while. You know, in the utility space, let's start with the fact that there are everything that you spend in the utility space is a pretty long-dated capital asset, right? You build a power plant, it's around for the next 40 to 50 years. You build a new transmission line, it's around for the next 40, 50 years. So we go through these capital cycles in the utility space where the utilities deploy a lot of capital into the system, and then sort of you stop doing that because the system has got all the capital it needs to run, and it's very well running. You know, so the last capital cycle versus the current one that we're in sort of ended in the early to mid 80s. And that was sort of the last time we built nuclear plants. So we sort of upgraded the transmission system at that point. And then basically you run off the depreciation of that grid until you need to start spending money on again. And that started sort of the capital cycle we're in today started sort of 2006, 2007. And one of the reasons that transmission was a big piece of that is the 2005 Energy Policy Act passed by the federal government. So that Energy Policy Act was passed in response to the 03 blackouts in the entire East Coast when a tree hit a transmission line in Ohio and basically blacked everybody out. We realized we had underinvested in the grid for probably too long and needed to spur investment in the grid. And what the Energy Policy Act basically did was say a couple of things. One that has worked well, it allowed the FERC, which is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, to incentivize equity returns for a transmission build in the United States. That has worked fairly well. They use a formulaic approach to calculate that return on equity. On a mark-to-market, that's about a 10% ROE, which is a notch better than what most utilities get from their state regulators to invest in other things besides transmission. One of the things that has not worked so well is an attempt to sort of open up transmission to competition, right? So it's still a regulated asset. It runs in a regulated monopoly because we don't want five transmission lines running next to each other going from the same place to the same place. But the way they tried to do this was to open up the bidding process to build a certain transmission line. And so a non-incumbent utility or a utility that doesn't operate or isn't the monopoly in that jurisdiction bid on a transmission line and potentially build it if approved by the regulator. There's a couple blockages to that. One is the regulator you're asking for approval from is the state regulator. The state regulator is most comfortable with the incumbent utility in terms of ability to get project done, in terms of relationship. The regulated utility and the regulator have been working together on investment in their state for the last 80 years, right? So it becomes a little parochial. And then the other point I would bring up, John, is honestly, like, it's very, very hard to site and permit a transmission line, right? So you're dealing with federal regulators that can kind of give you the economic return, which is good. So you want to go build transmission. But then you try to do a transmission line in a given state, and you run into people that don't want to look at it. No one wants it near their house. Does it run across certain farmland where that particular individual or corporate farm doesn't want it running through there? How do you permit it around some of the environmental stuff you have to deal with? So citing the route and permitting it, and then you have to deal with the state regulator in addition to all of that. So that process, frankly, can take 4 or 5 years to site and permit a line. And it might actually take you only 3 years to actually construct it, right? So there's kind of we want to build more transmission, but there's a little bit of a blockage in terms of the process you have to work through.
Well, you also talked about line resistance. I know you touched on it at the beginning there. I mean, can they actually, if there was the right set of circumstances, can they build a power plant or a photovoltaic cells out in New Mexico and sell it to New York? Maybe not today, but is that a possibility or is that out?
I think that is going to be very, very hard to do. Let's move to the other side of the Rocky Mountains, right? So I think that's very hard to do no matter what happens. But let's say you're building a wind farm in Kansas or Colorado where there's a lot of wind resource and you're trying to dispatch that back into New York. So you're trying to match the supply and demand. In theory, in the physics of it, you could actually build an underground DC transmission line, so direct current instead of alternating current. And you'd probably underground it just to make sure of the surety of supply. Undergrounding, as we know in New York, increases reliability massively because you don't have cars hitting telephone poles and you don't have storms blowing down lines and trees into lines, but you'd underground it and you'd send it from Kansas to New York and then you'd sort of put it through a transformer to put it back onto AC to get it back up to the New York grid where we could all use it. So it's possible. The problem is it's massively expensive. And so the more economic solution would be to site wind or solar more directly or closer to New York City. Now, you can still do it a little far away, right? So New York currently has a couple transmission lines that they've got on the drawing board that have been approved that are going to go from upstate. So, you know, well north of Albany, up by Lake Champlain, sort of, and come right down into New York City. And you're going to get renewables, wind and solar from upstate and dispatch that right into the New York City grid. Now, the way they dealt with that, you talked about this earlier, is who pays for all of this, right? You know, theoretically, the benefit of that line is for me and all the other people that live in New York City. But if you tried to charge the full cost of that line only to our bills, that would be pretty significant rate pressure and bill increases. So what New York did is they decided to say, no, what we're going to do, because this is clean energy for everybody, and it's helpful for the entire New York grid to put this generation online and make sure New York has enough power, we're going to socialize the cost across the entire state of New York. So if you're a New York bill payer, you are going to pay some portion of the line. But by doing that, because you're spreading it over more customers, it's about a 2% rate increase. So that makes it much more doable than charging everybody in New York some higher rate increase number. So that's always a debate too, who actually pays for the line. You know, where it dispatches is where customers see the benefit of the line output, but then there's job benefits, there's economic benefits in the counties it runs through. So there's benefits there, there's benefits to the generation end. But if you ran a massive line from Kansas to New York, and New York customers only tried to pay for that, that's massively expensive. And then you try to socialize it like New York did across all of those states, all of those jurisdictions, that gets so messy that it's almost, you know, it's impossible. And then you're running through, say, a state in the middle, right? And that state's customers are saying, well, why am I paying for a line that accrues no benefit to me, right? Those things make it difficult to do.
So it's alongside a railroad track could probably do it, but it would take maybe a strong federal leader.
You could do it along maybe a railroad track. You could maybe do it along the interstate highway system where you have a federal right of way. That's been sort of bandied about in the past, but you need legislation to do that. And we all just saw the Inflation Reduction Act and how that went backwards, forwards, upside down, inside out to get passed and finally did. But in our current political environment, legislation is very, very difficult to get across the finish line. So could happen, of course, always something to watch, but that's where you would see it if you would see it. You would see it along federal rights away where the federal government wouldn't have sort of all of these state issues, local issues, siting issues to sort of deal with.
You know, math wise, I never see anybody put math to this. Can you actually run this country on renewals 20 years from now?
Not on the economics of current technologies. So if you tried to do it today and go full clean energy, first of all, you'd have to keep the nuclear fleet operating. Nuclear fleet's about 20% of the grid today. Without that, you have no shot at 100% clean energy. Then you can get renewables pretty high. You can absolutely do that. The problem is you have no way to store the intermittent resource, right? Wind only works when the wind is blowing. Solar only works when the sun is shining. You can put that into batteries, but batteries dispatch after about 4 hours and then they're done. And the reason for that is batteries are basically designed for cars, not the electric grid, current state. And that's likely to continue to be the situation because cars will be the much higher demand for batteries over the long term than the electric grid will be. So you can kind of get to 70, 80% greenhouse gas reduction, right, with known technologies and on an economic affordable basis if you go at the right pace, right? So this, we're talking about achieving this in 2035, 2040. Then you sort of get to the point of you say, well, what about that last 20%, right? Because I need a resource that can run whenever I need it to, when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine and the batteries are done. Right now, that's natural gas. And so that's sort of talked about as the bridge fuel to get to this clean energy solution. Eventually, if you want to go full zero carbon, you have to solve that problem. Solving that problem has a couple different potential solutions, but the most likely in my mind are either carbon sequestration. So you burn natural gas in a power plant, and then you just pipe it to an old oil field or a geological formation, and you put it in the carbon dioxide and the greenhouse gases in the ground. Or you move to a hydrogen economy, where you're basically slowly replacing the natural gas system with hydrogen. You can blend hydrogen into today's natural gas system. You could, up to about 10 to 15%, but then you face significant material degradation of the pipeline and leak risk and other things. And hydrogen is more explosive than natural gas, so you don't want to do that from a safety perspective. So you can get there, but those solutions around hydrogen and carbon sequestration are not economic today. They have to become economic in the future that you're talking about. Now, that's totally possible, right? The Inflation Reduction Act had a lot of R&D incentives for people to go out and spend money on this stuff and try to figure it out. But you won't see significant, you'll see pilot programs in the utility space on some of this stuff as they try to like understand how it all works. You're not going to see significant investment in this, in my view, and the companies kind of tell us this as we talk to them about it, until the 2030s. And then you might start to see it slowly build from that perspective forward. But you're going to have to solve the last 20% with some, it's not new technology, right? We know how to turn water into hydrogen and oxygen. Every high school chemistry student, I think, still does that. But you have to figure out a way to do it economically at scale, which right now we don't have. Now, one of the big pieces of that, John, is you have to get to sort of a zero cost electricity to throw into the water to split it into its component parts. You can do that, but you have to sort of get to 60, 70% renewable penetration first, right? And then you'll have excess renewables running when the wind is blowing, the sun is shining, and we're not necessarily all using our air conditioning or all using our heating based on the weather and other things. So that's totally possible. But getting to 60, 70% renewable penetration, again, is going to take time. Because if you wanted to do it in 5 years, you could, but utility bills are going to go up massively to do that. So in order to make sure that it's affordable to reach the sustainability solution that we all want to get to, we have to go at an appropriate pace. And that pace is going to run us out to 2035, 2040.
A couple more quick ones before we get into maybe the investment opportunity side of this. Also, we talked about the supply chain issues. You can't just go to Walmart and get a so many ton generator. Talk a little bit about that. If they try to do stuff fast, they can't.
Yeah, so that is true, at least for the near term. So when we talk to our companies, they say, you know, look, even if I wanted to go faster right at the minute, I can't. Now, the solar panel supply chain is easing a little bit, still exists. I think transformers have come up a little bit as sort of the next one that people are a little bit concerned about. But you literally, and look, it's like supply chain with everything else, right? I mean, we've seen it certainly this year. And so, yeah, I think that's going to ease over time as we move forward. The solar panel situation is easing. I think the transformer situation eases, but there's short-term dislocations. So it's not like on the back of the Inflation Reduction Act, we're going to see in the near term massive increases in spending because we do have the supply chain issue. The other issue I'd point to is you're dealing with regulated monopolies in my world, right? They're not the most nimble, fastest moving companies in terms of new technology. And then because of the regulatory process, they generally set their capital spending budgets with their regulator a couple years out already. So you've already done that for 23, and a lot of companies, but not all, have done that for 24. So that's kind of where you are. And I think Steve wanted to add a little bit to this answer as well.
Yeah, I think the couple of other perspectives on the supply chain and the pacing of the growth here, this all involves a lot of labor. And I think it's pretty well known that there's tremendous labor challenges in the overall economy. And so there's really no quick or easy solution to that. And I cover the companies that do provide the engineering and construction labor, and they're trying the very best they can to enhance the workforce through different sourcing initiatives and training programs. But it's not something that can be easily done overnight. So that's one big picture thing to think about. So the other thing is related to the solar. There's also some incremental regulatory challenges as we as a country think about, you know, where we're sourcing the panels from and some of the labor practices that are involved in some of the production. And so that has created some incremental complications both here, and there's some developments of that in Europe as well. So those are some things for people to keep in mind as we think about what the growth rate it may look like going forward.
Brian, I have to ask this question before we get into how to make money on generation, transmission, distribution. The risk, you know, you hear, the Russians will take down the grid. You hear a lot of stuff about cyber and brownouts and storm. Can you just take a couple of minutes and tell us what the risks are as you guys see them?
I can sort of answer that. I think most of your clients have access to our research portal. We did an expert call with the former head of the NSA back in March on this question, shortly after sort of the Ukraine invasion, because it was a big concern. Quietly, his perspective, and I'm just giving you his perspective because I don't know, because the utilities can't be public about what they're doing on cyber for obvious reasons. But his view was that they've done a lot of work and spent a lot of money after the Ukraine grid was shut down by the Russians in 2015 on this issue, and they're pretty well coordinated. So look, is it always a risk? Yes, because we don't know what we don't know. But his view was that they've done a lot of preparation around this for the grid, which is pretty good. And that's all we could take. That's all we know, because they're pretty quiet about it otherwise for obvious security issues. So that's it. I would say, look, the grid is much more likely to be taken down by the more volatile weather that we have these days than by a cyber attack, if you're sort of thinking about the probabilities. And that leads to a lot of needed resiliency spending in the grid. So like storm hardening, higher towers, more structurally sound towers, so that we don't lose power when sort of things like hurricanes, or don't lose power for as long or as much when hurricanes or other storms like Winter Storm Uri in Texas last year and the cold weather come through. So that's driving spending in the space as well.
Well, I know we only have a couple minutes, and I didn't leave enough time for investment opportunities, but how about maybe, Steve, you give us some of the stocks and then we can talk about them with our clients separately after you guys check out.
So, yeah, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to discuss individual names on this forum, but happy to follow up with any of your folks on an individual basis. We do have research that we published a lot on the electric grid. We focused a lot on this green grid over the last couple of years. And again, I do cover engineering and construction companies and machinery companies that do have exposure to this area. And we encourage folks to read up on that research. And just by the way, as analysts, we do have certain disclosures that we need to make related to anything that we do discuss on these calls. And you can find those disclosures at ubs.com/disclosures, or you can reach out to any of us. But yeah, definitely lots of good opportunities. Happy to follow up on that topic at a later time.
Okay. Thanks, guys. I'll wrap it up myself. Thank you. Last couple of things. We have some research on that. And if anybody is interested in hearing about the stocks that we think can make money going forward, I didn't leave enough time for it, unfortunately. But we're going to circle back to that. So, John.
No, I appreciate the time, guys, for joining us today and talking about the electric grid. You know, it is a complicated subject. But if anyone on this call would like some additional research, feel free to reach out to us. We'd be happy to shoot it over to you. And if there's anything that you guys need, just let us know. And have a great weekend.
Thanks for having us.